Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to Anthony Albanese for coming along. It's the first time Mr. Albanese has been here as a minister. I'll introduce him very briefly. He was educated at Sydney University. He's worked in politics. He's worked as a political staffer, but most importantly as the MHR for Grainler since 1996, and then in the Labor opposition over a decade or so, he held a number of important shadow ministerial responsibilities. But of course, since the election of the Labor government in 2007, Anthony Albanese has held the important position of infrastructure, Minister for Infrastructure, Transport, Regional Development and Local Government. And of course, he's also the leader of the government in the House of Representatives, and he's speaking for us tonight on infrastructure, leadership and all that. So many thanks, Minister. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Jared, and I pay my respect to the traditional owners of country, past and present, pay respect to their elders. I also want to acknowledge former Premier Nick Greiner, who's here in the audience, and other members of the Sydney Institute. It is indeed a great pleasure to be able to speak to you this evening as the Commonwealth's first infrastructure minister. I have a joke at less formal occasions, but I'll do it given there aren't TV cameras here, which of course makes me Australia's best infrastructure minister ever. It also makes me something else, but I hope none of you will point that out. Tonight, indeed, we are not far from one of, indeed we can see out there, one of this nation's most recognisable examples of well-planned infrastructure, the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Built in the 20s and 30s, the designers had the foresight to build 8 lanes in anticipation of future demand. It's hard to imagine this great city without it. At the other end of the scale, we're also close to the mismatch of roads that is the Sydney CBD. These roads were generally constructed by chain gangs on the basis of the lines of least resistance or the path most often used by goats or bullocks. The results of this ad hoc approach to planning are more evident than ever, particularly at this time of the day when the city's workers start to head home. Well-designed infrastructure can literally shape a nation and deliver productivity benefits to the country for decades to come. This is the context for the Rudd government placing the national coordination of infrastructure as a central element of our economic reform agenda. Tonight I want to discuss the Rudd government's nation-building agenda and in particular the need for the Commonwealth to re-engage in policies that impact on our cities. The new government's approach is consistent with Labor's traditions, but that doesn't mean that we are simply repeating what's been done in the past. Consistent with our tradition as a dynamic political party that is prepared to look to the future, we are embarking on an innovative, comprehensive and transformative approach to delivering our vision. From the construction of the Snowy Mountains Hydro scheme under Chifley to the floating of the dollar under Hawke, Labor has always been willing to make pragmatic, tough decisions to both meet immediate challenges but also to support the nation's long-term interests. The last 18 years of economic growth had as their foundation the economic reforms championed by the Hawke and Keating governments, which made the Australian economy competitive in a globalised world. Today's challenges require new approaches and new solutions. Many of the previous Labor government reforms were the product of constructive dialogue between government, business and the community, including trade unions. The introduction of the superannuation guarantee is one example which will help to sustain the Australian economy in the long term. The Rudd government is once again engaging in constructive dialogue with the business sector in first framing and then fulfilling our agenda. As I met with the business community at conferences and around boardroom tables, in the 2 years in particular prior to last November's election, I was struck by the consistency of the message that I received. There were calls for a need for a national coordination and leadership on infrastructure, calls for the development of a pipeline of projects, calls to end the blame game, calls to remove impediments to investment. They were so consistent that they could have been on a pre-recorded loop. This was in harmony with the message from the Australian public. Infrastructure failings, of course, are often only noticed when they do fail. They have a real impact on Australians' everyday lives, and they have become increasingly frustrated over issues including urban congestion, water shortages, and limited broadband capacity. It's truly remarkable that the previous government was deaf to the growing noise around infrastructure. Even 20 warnings from the Reserve Bank of Australia about capacity constraints caused by infrastructure and skills shortages were ignored. I think this comes down to essentially an ideological view that the markets would look after it themselves, that it didn't require government leadership, in spite of the fact that report after report from organisations, including the Business Council of Australia, were calling for this national leadership on infrastructure. As Infrastructure Minister, I inherited a policy vacuum. The Rudd government has acted quickly to fill the void. We established an infrastructure department in the executive orders. We introduced legislation to create Infrastructure Australia in the first parliamentary session. Infrastructure Australia is a new way of doing business. It brings together all levels of government, but importantly, brings the private sector to the table. The appointment of Sir Rod Eddington as the chair of Infrastructure Australia was followed by the appointment of the 12-member advisory council. This included Mark Birrell, a former minister in the Kennett government in Victoria, from Infrastructure Partnerships Australia, Phil Hennessy from KPMG, Heather Ridout from the Australian Industry Group, Ross Rolfe from Babcock & Brown, and Gary Weaven from Industry Funds Management, as well as senior public servants, including Terry Moran, the head of PM&C, and Dr. Ken Henry from Treasury. This collaborative approach is consistent with the government's overall policy framework of support for market-based solutions, whilst also providing critical government leadership when it is required. If Infrastructure Australia provides the way, our decision to set aside $20 billion for the Building Australia Fund provides the means, or at least its beginning. This initial injection from the surplus is right for the times. It is one of the reasons why the surplus is being defended by the government as an essential component of responsible economic management. The budget, of course, produced a surplus, not as an end in itself, but a surplus with a purpose. A purpose in the short term, because it put downward pressure on inflation and downward pressure on interest rates, and a purpose in the long term, because it provided for the creation of these long-term investment funds, $20 billion into the Building Australia Fund, $11 billion into education infrastructure and $10 billion into health infrastructure. All of these designed to address capacity constraints and lift productivity. Every time there's an opposition vote in the Senate to diminish the surplus, they are voting to reduce the infrastructure spending that is available for the future. And I would argue putting short-term political interests before long-term national interests. The global economic uncertainty created by the credit squeeze and by rising global oil prices makes the budget decision to focus on these long-term funds and on infrastructure even more prescient. But there is another factor beyond our immediate economic and political considerations that underlines the government's approach. Australia as a nation must break the link between the electoral cycle and the investment cycle. Our predecessors squandered the opportunity that was presented by the resources boom to invest in our long-term future. Opportunities were wasted, which were presented by successive budget surpluses, because there was a concentration solely on boosting consumption at the expense of ignoring supply-side issues, including skills and infrastructure, which would boost productivity and secure prosperity for years and decades ahead. Governments will always be tempted to choose short-term recurrent expenditure over long-term capital expenditure. We need to produce structural change which reverses this pressure. For example, the minister who announces an infrastructure project rarely gets to preside over its opening. I believe that when human beings sit around the cabinet table and around expenditure review committees, this has an impact. And quite often there's pressure on governments at any level and at any ideological persuasion to go for that short-term political hit that comes from a one-off payment, as opposed to that long-term strategic investment, which makes far more sense. Infrastructure Australia's national audit is designed to turn that around. It's designed to break that three-year mindset. The government sees our infrastructure agenda as an enduring reform which will exist well beyond current circumstances. Now, whilst the infrastructure list is critical in establishing the priorities that will be needed for the Australian economy in years ahead, the government hasn't sat back and just waited for that. In the meantime, we've been progressing our nation-building agenda. In the budget, we brought forward expenditure on election commitments and announced new planning money and feasibility studies on potential projects. This morning, I joined with the Prime Minister in Townsville to turn the first sod on the Port Access Road. This is a $190 million project, $95 million from the Commonwealth, $95 million from the Queensland Government, which has been estimated could generate as much as $10 billion in economic activity for the North Queensland region. Yesterday, I was in Gladstone and Mackay announcing infrastructure funding once again for these booming regional centres. The Townsville Port Access Road is a practical example of smart government investment having a significant multiplier effect on the private sector and on the economy. It's been talked about for 30 years. The Prime Minister, when he was opposition leader, went there prior to the election and gave the commitment that we would actually get on with delivering it. And today, there are great big heavy machinery on that road getting it done, fulfilling that commitment. And it's a good example, I think, because ports are one of the areas that have been so constrained by a lack of investment and a lack of forward planning. Even before Infrastructure Australia began our work, we began pushing for transport policy reform through the Australian Transport Council. The Australian Transport Council is the body made up of the Commonwealth Transport Minister and each of the state and territory transport ministers. The ATC would normally meet over recent years, sometimes just once a year, but at most twice a year. Well, we've met three times in the last 5 months to make sure that the pressure's kept on to produce the reform agenda that has been left on the shelf for so many years. Many of the constraints of the current transport system are the legacy of different jurisdictional approaches to transport regulation. This inconsistent regulation places restrictions on the transport sector's capacity to move people and freight as efficiently as a modern economy demands. The Productivity Commission found in 2007 that improvements to the efficiency of the road and rail freight transport industry, including more streamlined regulation, could deliver as much as $2.4 billion to annual GDP. The constitutional compromises made by the Founding Fathers more than a century ago today creating real and significant disadvantages for the economy. Higher prices, higher business costs, and fewer export dollars. Common sense dictates that in a country of just 21 million people, one consistent set of transport laws and regulations is the position that we should be aspiring to. Let me give you some examples of the areas where reform is needed. Australia has 7 rail safety regulators, 3 rail safety investigators, and different rules in every state. The European Union, 27 separate countries, gets by with one. The United States gets by with one. It's extraordinary that in the 21st century, trains are required to change their staffing ratios as they cross borders. There are more than 50 pieces of legislation and subordinate legislative instruments pertaining to maritime safety, along with 8 independent maritime safety agencies. States do not automatically recognise maritime qualifications granted in another state. Different standards for commercial boat building apply in each jurisdiction. When truckies cross state borders, they're subject to different laws and have to put up with different frameworks for their vehicles' access to different roads. That's why the ATC will be recommending to COAG in October that it will give in-principle support to a number of policy initiatives to move Australia towards a framework of a national transport policy. These include a single national system for heavy vehicle regulation, registration and driver licensing, a national system for maritime safety regulation, and the establishment of a national road safety council. Separately, ATC will be continuing work on a proposal for a national rail safety regulator and investigator. Tonight I announce that the Rudd government has allocated $4.5 million this current financial year to meet the costs of the detailed work involved in accurately assessing the implications of proposed changes on industry through regulatory impact statements. This work will involve a thorough investigation of the costs, benefits and possible options for reform, providing a clear path to take these reforms forward. The work we are undertaking with the states and territories under the COAG umbrella is helping to break down the blame game which has afflicted our federation for far too long. Much of this transport agenda will inevitably focus on our major cities, where congestion is more acute. The Rudd government is re-engaging the Commonwealth in our cities. This reflects our strong belief that the success of our cities in large part drives our economy. Approximately 70% of our population live in cities. That 70% is delivering around 80% of Australia's economic activity. The major cities unit of the Commonwealth government will be located within Infrastructure Australia right here in Sydney. It will focus on 3 objectives. Firstly, productivity, reducing urban congestion and improving our freight networks so that people and goods can move more efficiently. Secondly, sustainability, ensuring that planning assists in the critical task of reducing carbon pollution and securing our water supply. And thirdly, livability, linked to the first 2 objectives, but remembering that there is indeed such a thing as society and that community participation and access to services is absolutely critical. We want to cast our eyes over the ways in which our cities operate and assess them against these 3 objectives. Our cities must learn from each other and from overseas cities while still retaining their own unique characteristics. There is a real opportunity here to make some small changes in our major cities, but which deliver big benefits. Many of these initiatives involve infrastructure provision, particularly improvements to public transport and road network design. However, much of the reform is broader than just infrastructure. It's about encouraging flexible work hours to avoid the rush hour peaks on our urban networks. It's about more distributed work centres to avoid concentrations in city centres. It's about transforming old industrial suburbs to greenhouse-friendly city developments. It's about undertaking urban renewal projects in older housing estates. Commonwealth re-engagement in our cities is also a necessary component of the whole of government response to climate change. It is in Australia's long-term interest to start the transition to a carbon-constrained economy. Climate change must be a key consideration in the design and functioning of our cities and in urban planning issues. In conclusion, can I say that infrastructure development is no longer a second-order issue without a voice in the Cabinet and without a dedicated Commonwealth agency. The Rudd government has made modernising our nation-building infrastructure a top priority because we understand the critical role it plays in driving higher productivity and greater prosperity for the long term. But this is not an economic reform for its own sake. It is a means to an end. We must never forget that infrastructure delivery impacts on the everyday lives of all Australians. It affects the price they pay for fruit and vegetables at the local supermarket. It determines whether there's enough water for their garden or electricity to power their homes. It impacts directly on the quality of their lives. And it is indeed a tragedy that many working parents spend more time commuting to and from work in their cars than they do at home with their kids. So the Rudd government is determined. We're determined to get infrastructure right. We're determined to reform the Federation. We're determined, through Infrastructure Australia, to ensure that long-term nation building receives more community support than short-term political decision making. If we don't change the dynamic so that no future government can disregard infrastructure investment, then it will be the community that suffers. That is why the Rudd government is passionate about pursuing our nation building agenda, and I'm very proud to be playing a part in that. Thank you for your attention this evening.
Many thanks, Minister. So we come to questions and discussion, but before we do, thanks to Mallesons for the use of this fine facility this evening, looking over Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Much infrastructure.
That's right.
So you've made a couple of important announcements here tonight, but can I just give you ask you to take a bit of a local perspective. The Rudd government, as you pointed out, has focused a lot on infrastructure, but here in New South Wales, we had an announcement yesterday that one of the major infrastructure projects, the North West Rail Link, is going to be postponed for some years. To what extent is the constricting economic environment internationally and the impact on Australia going to affect your bigger ideas for Infrastructure Australia?
Look, I think the important thing about the Infrastructure Australia agenda is that what we're trying to do is get the foundations right. So it's the right foundations that are long-term, beyond the life of the Rudd government, which I hope is very long indeed. But we hope that when government does change, as does occur, Infrastructure Australia stays, that it's a permanent reform. And what it enables us to do is to put infrastructure in the centre of longer-term macroeconomic strategy as well. There's an argument that the times, in fact, including the difficult economic times internationally, suit the fact that we set up these long-term infrastructure funds and that at times of contraction, you would want to spend more of the Building Australia Fund and other infrastructure funds in order to have an impact of an expansionary impact on the economy, but infrastructure has an advantage in that it is a less inflationary economic tool than simply consumption, than simply putting money out in other forms which governments may choose to do from time to time in the form of one-off payments or changes to tax arrangements. So I think the times suit us. We obviously had these plans in place for some time, but I think looking back, the May budget looks like pretty sensible economic policy, even more so perhaps than it did in May at the time.
Commissioner.
I appreciate your talk very much because I think it's about high time that the infrastructure of Australia is being standardised. But the word infrastructure baffles me a little bit because the infrastructure of a nation comprises more than what you were talking about. Doesn't the infrastructure of a nation include health, the hospitals, education, university research, etc.? So would that be part of your infrastructure group also to analyse?
Look, it does indeed, and that's why in the budget, as I outlined, we had $41 billion into these long-term investment funds, $11 billion of that into education, particularly targeting universities and TAFE, and $10 billion into hospital infrastructure. So the government has taken that into account, certainly. In terms of the priority list that will be produced by Infrastructure Australia, it will concentrate, we've said, on the more economic side, if you like, nation-building infrastructure, so road, rail, ports, broadband, more infrastructure that has an impact beyond a particular community. Why is that the case? Because if you took a broader definition of infrastructure, you would essentially abolish the government and just have Infrastructure Australia, and the other ministers mightn't like that idea. So there are limits as well in terms of the expertise, in terms of service delivery by the states, but also in terms of the education and health budgets as well. So there are limits. But one of the things that Infrastructure Australia is looking at is beyond, it shouldn't be considered that its agenda is just, you know, there's limited, deliberately out of respect to the audience and out of fear from Jared, restricted the time of the speech. We're looking at well beyond just infrastructure investment. We're looking at having uniform public-private partnerships, for example. Now, that paper will go to COAG in October. As well, getting some national consistency. So how do you get investment into infrastructure, whether it be roads or rail or schools or hospitals, in a way which reduces some of the costs of doing business as well? So a lot of the reform that's required isn't about spending money. It's actually about saving money, reducing costs. So we're also looking at expanded reforms, including how do we get some consistency in... Now, I probably shouldn't say this at Mallesons or any law firm, but the truth is that a whole lot of the costs of infrastructure development are built up because of the inconsistent regulation and rules that occur across state jurisdictions. There's armies of lawyers around this nation are employed on the sole basis because you need to be an expert in Melbourne, can't do business in Sydney because there's a whole different series of rules. Why is that the case? Let's look at ways in which we can cut down costs of infrastructure provision, regardless of what sector it's aimed at as well.
Thanks. There's a question here, then we go up here. Yep.
Minister, I'd like to ask about the Hume Highway to Melbourne and the Pacific Highway to Brisbane. For many years, state and federal politicians of both political parties have talked about making those roads dual carriageways. Every year, a whole lot of people needlessly die on those roads. Where does that project fit on your list of priorities?
Well, the Hume, there's been substantial progress occurring, and we recently had an opening. Essentially, you will get... I'm not sure in terms of the time frame of where it's at, but I'm happy to get that precise information for you. On the Pacific Highway, we're contributing $2.45 billion. The other day I drove between Port Macquarie and Taree, just happened to be up there with Rob Oakeshott a couple of weeks ago, And it is one big roadworks. It is quite extraordinary. One of the constraints that's there on completing the Hume, the Pacific, the Bruce, is also the other side of the capacity constraint equation, which is skills. Literally, we have got a problem. It's not just a financial problem. You don't have the people to actually, the engineers at that level in terms of the roads, or in terms of literally skilled labour to do the work. There'll be on the Pacific Highway between Port Macquarie and Taree over 1,000 people working on it by December. It's struggling in terms of, and that's leading to a massive increase, of course, in costs as well, labour costs on top of the costs that are there with... The Prime Minister was the bit of road that we're doing in Townsville that we announced today. The Prime Minister was surprised that $190 million buys you 10 kilometres of road, 10 k's, $19 million a k. That's what you're talking about. So you think about where other priorities are and the pressures that are there, and that's why $2.45 billion doesn't give you the full Pacific Highway. It does give you, though, pretty much a substantial element there, and we're spending $2.2 billion on the Bruce Highway as well.
So in Townsville, how much of that money is federal, how much is state, and is there any private money in that as well?
No, there's not. It's a 50-50 split, 95-95, built in two stages. The first stage is 2.5 kilometres. Which will take away, that's quite expensive, it'll take away the road away from the communities as well. So it's actually quite a good social dividend as well. And what we're doing there, though, is building in, as a bonus, it's a good example of planning, we're building in a rail corridor as well being reserved. So some of that is looking to the future of an expanded rail facility there as well.
Here and there.
Greener power generation infrastructure. Do you have any specific allocations for either solar or hot rocks pilot projects?
Look, there's a range of infrastructure projects. I refer to my comments on education and health in energy as well as a separate portfolio. The government is putting substantial amounts into solar research and into solar pilot projects, both in terms of individual household subsidies and loans, our solar schools program, but also our renewable energy programs, which include support for geothermal. Martin Ferguson, the minister, had a major announcement about 10 days ago about an expanded support from the Commonwealth for geothermal. We think that not only is that good in itself, but some of the research there has a significant potential for export into the region. I mean, we were the only country on earth that during this decade has seen solar projects shut down. Wind in the form of Vestas in Tasmania closed their factory. Pacific Solar, of course, is located in Munich. We need to turn that around. We think there are challenges presented by climate change, but also massive opportunities. We've been very good at research. What we haven't been very good at is commercialising that ourselves. So we need to get much better at that.
We've got plenty of time, so okay. Yeah.
Going back to freeways, highways, and all of that, where does use of pays come into all of this? And one of the most, it seems to me, going to visit relatives in Melbourne, one of the most successful things has been this huge ring road thing that's done in Melbourne. And this was really fought for by the Kennett government after successive governments had trouble and sold off the land and whatever. One of the most unsuccessful things has been the Cross City Tunnel in Sydney. And in both those cases, it's user pays. So how do we get over the problem of people thinking that it's all got to be government or it's all got to be, you know, given, and resenting the fact that they need to pay? And where do you, where can it be that it's so good people will want to pay? How do you do this?
Well, I don't think you have to go to Melbourne. I think M7 Westlink is a great example of a public-private partnership that is effective, that's efficient, that has opened up massive economic opportunities in Western Sydney. A partnership between the Commonwealth, the state and the private sector. That's why we want to get the PPP guidelines right. You'll always hear about the bad stories with PPPs, never the good. The truth is that we have conservatively $400 billion of infrastructure spending required over the next decade. Is all that going to be provided by the public sector? No, it is not. So therefore, we have to look at ways in which we can encourage private sector investment. And one of the things that Infrastructure Australia will do is assess projects on their merits, not pick who gets what contracts or what have you, but assess projects on the basis of a proper cost-benefit analysis of what the most appropriate and efficient financing option is. I think we're going to have to look at ensuring that it's right. If you look at some of the issues with some of the negative aspects of PPPs in the past, it's where risk hasn't been transferred properly, where the public sector has sought to utilise private sector finance and has then given them all these options and guarantees on the way through. Well, you know, the outcome is there for people to see. There are a number of very good PPP examples. The M7 Westlink, to use another in this town, in education. The building and maintenance of schools. What the New South Wales government did then was to make sure that the schools that were built by the private sector were also had in, as part of the contract deal, a maintenance provision, so that the principals and the PNC and the people around the schools could concentrate on doing what they should be doing, which is teaching kids, not working out how to fix the leaky tap or the toilet in the boys' dorm. Really good examples. I think the hospitals that are being built under PPPs in Victoria at the moment are another good example. Built. The private sector is very good at building things efficiently. We need to make sure, though, that benefit of private sector involvement is kept there. You can't say that and then build in all these conditions so that if it's not efficient and it's not on time, the public sector bail out bear the consequences. I think the general public's quite rightly very annoyed when that occurs. But we also need to recognise, I think, be a bit honest as well about public debate on those issues. The Cross City Tunnel hasn't met expectations in terms of vehicles. But I use the example of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. There's a hell of a lot more vehicles going through the Cross City Tunnel than went across the Harbour Bridge in the 30s. You know, and I think that we have this mentality of immediate success. I think in the long term, just like Darling Harbour was opposed, you know, it was terrible, the urban renewal, you know, we're often very negative about these issues. And I think One of the reasons for the infrastructure priority list looking ahead is that we do need to get away from, whether it be from the public sector or from the private sector, which is one of the problems we have with our ports, is just-in-time provision of infrastructure. So there's a building incentive there to, because the private sector concerns have an incentive to maximise their dividend in the short term, they're not building the capacity in there, even though some of that capacity is not used capacity, the long-term economic consequences of that for the company it's themselves is negative, but the short-term, because the pressure's on and boards of directors get incentives based upon the short-term 12-month outcome, we need to look at those issues as well and have that debate, I think, in the community.
So the question right off the bat, let me go here and here. Yes?
I'm just following on from Jared's first question about the Northwest Metro, which I'm extremely concerned about. I work for an engineering company that is currently doing a preliminary environmental assessment for that job. I guess, is the Commonwealth prepared to step in, whether it's a PPP or direct government funding, to a major infrastructure project that has been crying out for many, many decades to, I guess, extend the economic expansion of that area and a much-needed transport link?
Well, as much as I'd like to give the Sydney Institute publicity from making a major announcement of tens of billions of dollars this evening, that's actually not the way that we're going to do policy. We've actually set up Infrastructure Australia so that we have a group of people sitting over there in the Deutsche Bank building, meeting, making assessments on projects based upon their contribution to the productivity of the economy. So they'll be making those assessments. Any project is eligible for assessment if submitted by state governments, and indeed we've opened up the process to the private sector or the community to participate in that. We'll be making those assessments based upon national interest grounds, not on grounds of any particular state government or any particular interest which is there. So one of the feasibility studies that we've put in is which we're funding along with the state government as part of the announcement in the budget, is the Western Metro Line. The second one in terms of New South Wales is the M5 duplication to the port. So we did a number of those projects to give an indication of the sort of major projects that we'd be interested in participating in.
Excuse me, why Deutsche and not the Australian bank?
Hang on, just a minute.
Look,
just a minute. We're just taking this in order. Just hang on. Okay, there's a question down there, and then there's one there. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then Harold after you. Yeah.
Can we talk a bit about the funding side? The Commonwealth governments are given a surplus, and that's no longer active in the bond markets. When we've sort of dealt with infrastructure in the past, we look at things like these infrastructure bonds and things like that. Are we likely to see your vehicle Infrastructure Australia offering direct investment opportunities for the public and things like that in lieu of a government sort of?
Look, that would be a part of, if it were to be progressed, wouldn't be done so much by Infrastructure Australia, but would be a part of Treasury policy, basically. And would fit in with the priorities or decision making of Treasury at the time. Treasury, of course, sit on the Infrastructure Australia board as well as one of the reps. We made sure we didn't want infrastructure to be this thing at the side. We wanted Prime Minister and Cabinet and Treasury to be right there at the table. At this stage, I know of no proposals along those lines.
And before I call Harold, I should clarify. The Minister was saying that Infrastructure Australia is based in the Deutsche Bank building. He wasn't saying it's based in Deutsche Bank. It's just in the Deutsche Bank building. Deutsche Bank, no doubt, would like it to be the other way, but that's not the way. Harold, yeah.
Minister, the bipartisan Sustainable Cities Committee, few years old now, but including people like Malcolm Turnbull, recommended that the federal government should move into public transport. It noted that, unlike most countries where the federal government has spent a lot of money in public transport, we've been putting most of it into road. And do you envisage that there will be a big shift by the Commonwealth into investment in public transport. And could that lead down to the level of things like the metro or things like, you know, just public transport systems within capital cities, as opposed to having the states being the builders and contributors to those infrastructure requirements?
Well, the Sustainable Cities Report, of course, was bipartisan, but the then government didn't even bother to put in a response to the report, so it lapsed. And Malcolm Turnbull sat on the committee, but then sat in the cabinet, and nothing happened at all to the recommendations. So I make that point, just because I can. Now that we've got that out of the way, you never know, Malcolm might get there, so we've got to, you know. We're already doing it. We're funding, we've stumped up money for the Western Metro feasibility project, which I think is 20 mil. I'm looking for an advisor there in total. $20 million for that. We're funding in South Australia the transport sustainability study, which includes, they're looking at a range of options there that certainly include public transport options. In Perth, we're funding the feasibility study for the rail line, which would go from the airport into the CBD. In Melbourne, we're looking at the Eddington report that was done there, which includes a tunnel for the rail line, a cross-city tunnel, basically, for the rail line there as options. So the fact that we're putting money into the feasibility studies for a start is more than happened in the previous 12 years. And we've indicated that we certainly don't have a view that there are two things. It's probably best to explain it by what we don't think is right. One is we don't think that the road versus rail debate is mature or sensible in a country as big as we are. The fact is that they're interrelated. You need an integrated transport system. The second, therefore, is that you can't... traditionally, the Commonwealth has, through AusLink, funded just roads, mainly in regional areas. Highways have been a part of that, but they've been funded just to the outskirts of cities, and a lot of it's been about freight. But, of course, you get to the outskirts of cities, and then it can take you an enormous amount of... to get time and therefore money to get the goods actually to the port, whether it be Brisbane, Port Botany or Melbourne. You also can't have a strategy for moving freight without a strategy for moving people. If we actually have a strategy that gets people out of their cars and into public transport, that has efficiencies for road users as well. There's an interrelationship there, and I think quite often there's a... So you've got to be a cheerer for rail or a cheerer for road, you know, the Commonwealth has nothing to do with public transport. We think that's a wrong approach, and so part of Infrastructure Australia's assessments won't be to start off saying, well, public transport's off the agenda. Various public transport proposals will be considered as part of the development of the priority list.
Question? My question's a follow-up to the question asked by the lady here on my left regarding user-pay projects. Understand that the main criterion for ranking projects that IA is going to apply will be whether or not the project would make a material contribution or improvement to national productivity. And I guess I wonder whether that's in a real sense or in relative terms, i.e. relative to the amount invested. But, I mean, does that mean, for example, that if a project is publicly you know, a project which is capable of being publicly funded or privately funded, if it's privately funded, thereby reducing the amount of the government contribution to a project, that would result in the project being elevated up the list, up above another project which for the same amount of total expenditure would deliver a bigger boost to national productivity.
Yeah, look, I mean, there are cases where a small amount of seed money from the public sector can make a big difference to whether private investment goes ahead. You know, and we will certainly consider that as well, whether that's the difference between it or not. You know, and that's why in terms of the part of the funding assessment has to be also income, which goes to the user pays principle as well. An example of, to go back to Jared's first question, the Townsville Port Access Road is solely publicly funded, but what's happening because of that, there's massive private investment in other roads to access it, potentially in the rail line, potentially in other intermodal hubs around there. There's a whole area of change occurring, where essentially cane fields around Mackay and Townsville are being replaced by industry hubs. You can actually see it physically happening. It's extraordinary, the growth up there. So that small amount of difference that the public sector can make, and of course that produces revenue back. That's one of the failings, I think, of the argument that infrastructure investment's just a cost, not an investment. Is that if you invest, you know, in that road, for example, and more goods can get exported out through the port, then that leads to greater income back to the Commonwealth in the form of taxation revenue.
Final question.
Yes, I presume the Commonwealth would expect the states to contribute substantially to infrastructure within the states, allow what you described in Queensland. Given the state of the New South Wales finances, that seems unlikely from the point of view of New South Wales, that they'll be able to afford or will be able to afford any major nation-building infrastructure in this state in the foreseeable future. Does that mean that New South Wales is going to be left out of this whole process, or how do you see a way around that?
No, well, I think I'm not going to do a running commentary on New South Wales, but I do have a view about what incoming treasuries have to say, and they're pretty consistent, and we'll see what the reality is from the assessments. But the fact is that the New South Wales government in its last budget had record infrastructure spending. It was the biggest infrastructure spend by any state government in the history of the nation for about 2 days, I think, and then Queensland brought down its budget, which topped it. So, you know, the spending is there. I mean, I think there's a whole range of philosophical reasons why we can point towards a failure of infrastructure spending over a period of time, and we can get into a debate about whether zero debt makes sense for governments as an objective. Which the New South Wales government had as an objective, of course, for a time, and that was a response to problems that had occurred with state governments in Victoria and South Australia in particular. But we need to get real about it. All the states will be eligible to participate in the process. Certainly we will expect that state governments contribute as well to projects in terms of their viability. But one of the things that we won't do, and I've said this a few times to the premiers, this isn't going to be a business as usual cake, where immediately we announced the Building Australia Fund, you had three state premiers between them divided up 130% of the cake. That's before you got to the other three. because they all said, well, you know, our population is X, plus you put a bonus on because we're growing faster than anyone else, and plus you put a... It's not going to be like that. We're not going to have that sort of carve-up. You're going to have to put your case to Infrastructure Australia in terms of the priority list. And everyone on the board, the reason why it's an advisory council rather than a statutory advisory board is that people take off their hats when they go in the room. I've sat through a couple of their, not all of their meetings, but I've addressed two of their meetings. And it's a dynamic, quite exciting group. They're doing a lot of work on it, and they'll do it on the basis of good economic outcomes and cost-benefit analysis, not on the basis of, you know, what might be a political decision-making process based upon, you know, what if a state has 20% of the population, they deserve 20% of the projects. We actually need to move beyond that and to actually make sure that we have outcomes that are truly in the national interest.
Minister, many thanks. Take a seat.
Thank you.
We could have gone on, but we always have a rule of finishing by 7 o'clock, and the Minister gave a prompt speech. He was very much to time, but we've had over half an hour questions and discussion, and all good things must come to an end. So I'd just like to say, again, thanks to Mellicent, but to Anthony Albanese, certainly he's put infrastructure on the political map in Australia. There's much more discussion about it than there was before. We could see it here tonight, a very diverse audience, lots of questions, and we could have gone on. So we're very grateful that the Minister found time in a very busy schedule to come and speak for us tonight. The paper will be published in due course in the Sydney papers. No doubt there'll be some reportage tomorrow. It'll be up on our podcast tomorrow as well. But for tonight, to Anthony Albanese, many thanks, and no doubt we'll have you back again in the future. We'll look forward to that.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.